We're doomed, we're saved.
The BioRevolution Podcast.
Your hosts, Luise von Stechow
and Andreas Horchler. We're doomed, we're saved, episode number 24. Welcome, Luise, how are you?
I'm excellent, just returning from holidays.
That's very nice. Scandinavia, right?
Yes, exactly. Wow, Norway, amazing. Sweden, Denmark.
Sounds good to me. So today, artificial intelligence, hope for rare disease patients, somewhat a topic in a niche, one could say, maybe, but we bring it to the forefront in We're Doomed, We're Saved. We will define rare diseases, the state of research, of course, the reality in the pharma industry and means of AI possibly tackling the major problems that come with rare diseases and their treatment. As always, you brought a quote.
Yeah, I brought a quote. I think from someone that we might have quoted before, actually.
I guess so.
I'm not quite sure because he might come up more often than we would think. It's Bill Gates, who, of course, I think also spent some time thinking about the state of AI and the state of the world and the state of the digital world, of course. And I think starting as a computer pioneer, but then turning into a full-time philanthropist, he really shifted his interest. And in an open letter in the World Economic Forum last year, he thought about what actually artificial intelligence can do for humanity and put the example or the use case of using artificial intelligence to serve underserved diseases. So to help address unmet needs for different diseases where there are no treatments, where there is no care opportunities for the patients. And what he says is it's hard to imagine a better use of AI than saving the lives of children.
Yeah, well put. Yeah. An avid reader as well. So you might always check his best of list monthly, which is quite telling.
I actually do.
Yeah. So orphan or rare diseases, if we do a shallow internet research, we come up with things like, I have to read it, Durkheim's disease, Farr's disease, Devic's disease, tardive dyssakinuria, I can't even pronounce it, or Landau-Kleffner syndrome. Those are the things that pop up, really, if you do a Google, no clue what they are, but let's try and define what rare diseases are and why it is rather hard to come up with solutions.
Yeah, so rare diseases are a common term, a basket for a number of diseases, some of which you listed, some of which are a bit better known. Hemophilia, for example, sickle cell anemia, cystic fibrosis, Huntington's are a number of names that I think also for the general public might be something that puts a clearer image. They're often named after the physicians who discovered them. So therefore, they're often a little bit clunky names for the disease.
Absolutely.
Sometimes they're also termed after the key symptom, for example, maple syrup urine kind of disease.
Okay.
So they're different types. But in general, rare diseases are diseases that affect only a very small percentage of people. And this varies, this definition, what makes a disease rare. There are some cutoffs in different countries that make a disease applicable for so-called orphan instruments that actually incentivize drug makers, and we'll talk about that in a second. And this tells you a little bit how rare a disease has to be called rare. So, for example, in the European Union, the European Medicine Agency defines a rare disease that has a prevalence of less than 5 in 10,000. And in the United States, it's designated as a disease that affects fewer than 200,000 people in the United States. And I think in Japan, it's fewer than 50,000 in Japan.
So it's kind of one approach is percentage, the other is total numbers.
Yeah. That said, also diseases that are more common, but for which drug makers are unlikely to get a significant payoff for the development of drugs, are sometimes counted as orphan diseases, even though they are not as rare. And we talked about the unmet need when it comes to antibiotic development.
Absolutely.
So
this
would be a use case, for example, where you could say this is a high unmet need, but the drug makers are very unlikely to make a lot of money with it. So maybe this could be called an orphan disease.
Okay, so we have an intro. Let's talk about the drug discovery or grasping the disease root, so to speak. It's evident that pharma acts rather reluctant, of course, and you had the in the intro portion already mentioning that it doesn't make essentially sense for big pharma to develop drugs for rare diseases because they are rare, of course. And that's a reason that they are reluctant to put in large amounts of money into R&D, of course, at the one hand side, and B, it's even hard to collect sufficient data, right?
Exactly, yeah. So I think to sum it up, and I think one very important thing about rare diseases, like the single rare disease is rare, but taken all together, they're quite common. There are some estimates of around 350 million people worldwide having rare diseases. So
yeah,
that's a lot, actually. It's, yeah, it's a massive untapped potential for the pharmaceutical industry to develop drugs. The problem, as you say, is really the rarity of the patient. So if you have a disease for which you only have 50, 100, 500 people worldwide suffering from the disease, or even a few more, it might be commercially very unattractive to develop a drug there, because developing a drug is very expensive. It's around, estimates really vary, but a commonly quoted number, I think, that we also included in this podcast a couple of times, is around $2 billion for the development of a drug. So spending this money and then having very few people to which to sell this drug to is not very attractive. That said, orphan drugs and especially newer modalities, we talked about gene therapies, which are very commonly used, or most commonly used, for genetic diseases, which are often these rare diseases, sickle cell anemia, for example, hemophilia. These are among the most expensive drugs that are out there on the market. And this is not because the pharmaceutical industry wants to scrape money from people in dire need, but it's because they need to somehow bring back the money that they spend on the development.
Of course, and they can't scale it like they would be able to scale aspirin or something.
Exactly, exactly. And that's one of the challenges. To make it more attractive for drug makers to move into the space, there are these so-called orphan instruments. So in 1983, there was the Orphan Drug Act in the United States. It's my age, actually. And this has really helped to incentivize drug makers to venture into the space that has this high unmet need. On the one hand, they get some tax refunds, or they used to get some tax refunds for the development costs. You have extended market exclusivities. You're for a longer time the only person who is allowed to sell this drug in the market. So there's this question of generics that surrounds this whole patent discussion. And also you get more guidance in terms of how to develop the drug. And this is actually quite important. I think it's underestimated how difficult it is to get the whole structure around how to develop a drug right. So which patients do you test it, and how much effect do you need to show? And if you move to this rare disease field, you might have very few patients, as you say, on which to test the drug. Mm-hmm. So it has to get the best possible data that you can collect in these few patients if you want to show that it has any positive effect, and no negative. I mean, very importantly, of course, you want to weigh the efficacy of the drug against the safety.
Sure.
So you do not want to do something that hurts these patients even more.
So on the path of helping those people, there are two developments. One is one we've been talking about constantly, which is AI, obviously, and the gaining ground of AI in the field of biology and medicine and drug development in general. And on the other hand, a more individualistic approach to patient care all together. I guess both go together. And now we want to dig in a little bit into the field of rare diseases, how AI and this new approach can help.
Yeah. So I think the key challenge that we just brought up, or the main challenge, is you have too few patients, or you have very few patients. The model of the pharmaceutical industry is not generally tailored for this. That said, of course, you can address these unmet needs for these patients if you use the right approaches. And I think there, the question of innovation and moving away from this classical blockbuster model, I think we once had Jochen Maas as a guest,
sure,
and we discussed stepping away from the classical, this big selling pill that you can sell to a lot of people that makes you a lot of money.
Although we've been talking about Ozempic recently, which is definitely a new blockbuster.
Don't make me sing the jingle now because I get it stuck in my head all the time.
Okay.
I might do that at the end of the episode.
All right.
No, but I think...
I don't know it. Yeah, so you can sing it to me.
I will. The business model might shift towards a much more personalized approach. And I think there AI can be tremendously helpful by bridging gaps in the data. So you have very few patients and you have missing data points. You only know how it might look in this. You have this one case study from this region, and then you have another patient who is 50 years older and might have a slightly different mutation and a different phenotype. And somehow you try to bring this all together to develop a drug. What you need to develop a drug is to actually first understand the disease. And this is, I mean, quite tricky if you have a rare disease about which very little is known. The second part that's quite challenging is that often the patients are misdiagnosed. So there was just a very recent study coming out in Nature Medicine or Nature Genomics Medicine, I think, where they interviewed, I think it was like a really large number of patients, 6,500 patients across 40 countries, across I think over 1,000 rare diseases. So it's like a really big sample. And overall, on average, these patients had waited 5 years to get the right diagnosis.
Wow.
And I think like 1/5 of the patient had talked to, I think, 8 healthcare professionals. So that's, I mean, it's massive. Yeah, you can imagine. And many of these diseases being genetic diseases, so I think around 80% have a genetic factor. They manifest also early in life, so it's children. So you can imagine having a sick child and running through different doctors for 5 years until you know what you actually have. And this is also time that you lose on having a potential treatment or a care approach for the illness, and you might get actually the wrong treatment, which makes it worse.
Mm-hmm.
So that is pretty bad. So getting to a diagnosis earlier, and as I said, you have around 80% of these diseases having a genetic component, so you might actually have a genetic test. So you need to tackle out how does this phenotype of the disease link to a certain gene.
Understood.
Or combination of genes. Mm-hmm. And this is a huge opportunity, but it's not as easy as it might sound. And I mean, we talked in the episode 22, we talked about the polygenic risk scores and the difficulty of assigning variation in genes to phenotypes of diseases. And I think this is, for rare diseases, also a challenge, even if many of those are actually monogenic, so you have only one gene that's affected, you still need to actually find it.
Yeah, yeah. And in a sense, you get approximation, but not evidence necessarily.
Yeah, and I mean, what you need is to really find, you need to find it at it. You need to find the gene while it's doing it.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Often in the biobanks, you might lack the correct gene, or you might lack the information about the phenotype-genotype correlation. And this is something, there are a number of companies, one in Berlin, for example, Nostos Genomics, and then there's also Genomenon, that's a US-based company, and a number of academic institutions that are actually working on putting together the genetic makeup, so understanding which genes could actually be linked to different rare disease phenotypes, using artificial intelligence. And this is, I mean, super interesting, of course, and they are adding different layers of data into the mix as well to get a better picture. And in the best case, so you need to imagine you have a biobank and you miss the right mutation that would link to your disease, but because your model was trained on a very broad data set, you would actually still get the information which this disease might be through the inference.
And this leads to a quick diagnosis.
Exactly. And leads to a quick diagnosis and treatment. Yes. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you might not have a treatment, but I think already having the diagnosis is worth a lot because, again, moving back, on the one hand, the patient wants to know which disease they might have. But on the other hand, in order to develop a drug, it's very helpful to know what the patient actually has. It's good to know what the disease is. And again, if you have a genetic root of the disease, you can develop many of these new type of modalities, also called ATMPs, so advanced therapeutic products that have the potential to really be curative. So you have gene therapies, but you also have other types of nucleotide-based therapies that really could cure the disease or have be a very long-term treatment for the disease rather than having something that you have to take every month. So that has a huge potential.
Do you have an estimate where those companies and research bodies at universities stand right now? So do we have an estimate when this is going to lead to some amount of success?
I mean, when it comes, I think, to the diagnosis, it's, I would say many of it is relatively early stage, so it's a little bit hard to really put a number to it, but there are case studies of these approaches being successful. And I think basically any additionally diagnosed patient is a great success, right? So
true,
because
yeah,
again,
absolutely,
it's really about the single patient and having,
right,
having your diagnosis is a success.
Yeah.
And I think this will likely, because I mean, we have, I think we talked about it a couple of episodes ago, this really massive improvement in next generation sequencing. So it's mm-hmm. much faster and much cheaper to sequence genomes. And then we have this added component now of having artificial intelligence that really can help the researchers make sense of it much faster and much better. And I think this has the potential to really help diagnosing and maybe making it also more standard procedure to scan for various mutations that usually you have a small panel of mutations that you might screen for, but then you can go much broader. You can throw your net out
true,
much wider
true,
and take
yeah.
in some fish that you didn't actually think about,
yeah.
some diseases that, yeah. The problem, I think there are around like 7,000 rare diseases. And I mean, it's not unexpectedly, the general physician will not have all of them in mind if you get a sick child with diffuse symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I mean, some of them have a very clear set of symptoms where you say like, okay, this must be that, but many don't. And then you need to somehow find how can I track this diffuse set of things with different organs or with just general lack of thriving. What can I attribute that to?
We're on the wing of diagnosis, but then we have the drug development in itself. And do you think that with these processes that are in place or are beginning to take their place and the regulatory framework that in part is still in development, that we will have a faster process of drug development? That said, also the likelihood to make it commercially attractive for big pharma to dig into rare diseases a little bit more?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think this is the promise of artificial intelligence. I mean, it's a two-pronged thing. On the one hand, it can make the development faster and cheaper. And I think this is a huge benefit. And especially for rare diseases where you know you have very few patients and many of the classical ways of developing a drug will not work because
right.
you simply do not have the amount. You cannot produce the amount of data that you would need for it.
Of course.
And there, having workarounds and being faster can be really, really helpful. So I mean, we talked about this bad number of 2 billion or more, but there's also another bad number, which is that any drug that enters the clinic has on average around a failure rate of 90%. That means not only is it very expensive.
Bad ratio.
But it also mm-hmm. just has a super high attrition rate. And the drugs that make it to the market have to pay for the ones that don't. So that means you need to somehow bring in the money and you cannot bet on endless. I mean, if you would have endless money to spend, maybe Bill Gates can fix that or Warren Buffett or someone, then you could, of course, test many, many more hypotheses and have more shots on goal and then be more successful to also cure these rare diseases. You have to really limit the shots on goal that you take when you're in pharma in order to get to something that works and something that...
Not ruin the company.
Exactly, yeah. And not ruin also the chances for patients because I think, I mean, one has to think that successful drugs, of course, benefit pharma, but they also benefit the patients. You need this model to work in order to be innovative, to bring new treatments. And I think if you have AI that can make processes leaner, but also that can help finding targets on the one hand, so really going back to the also genomic side, but also to the interpretation of large amounts of data, imaging data, etc., you have, of course, much higher opportunity to find the right target. You have a better opportunity to find the molecule that you need faster. And by doing that, you save money and you have more shots on goal. So basically, you increase the chances of finding something.
Given that I overdo it a little bit now that you have shots on goal for free, basically through AI, yeah, more or less. Is pharma and is research going to be seduced by AI? Because this podcast is We're Doomed, We're Saved. We're talking about saving only until now. But there might be some doom included into that, trusting AI too much in the process.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, there is a key challenge, and I think especially when it comes to rare diseases, because there it's really patient focused. So because you have very few patients, the patients themselves and or their caretakers, their parents, but also their advocates, often you have like organizations that are patient support organizations. Also their physicians often turn into their advocates because they are just very close, the patients and the people with whom they work. So they're with this really strong patient advocacy and patient focus, they will also want to understand what the artificial intelligence does. And I think when it comes to discovering targets and molecules, probably this won't matter that much, but wherever the patient is directly involved, so when it comes to diagnosing, but also when it comes to clinical development, there the patients need to trust and the physicians need to trust because they don't want to do anything that's bad for them. And at the current stage, most artificial intelligence models are black boxes, so we don't know what goes in there.
Right.
And there's an additional layer of complexity due to data privacy, which in this field where you have very few patients, very few data points, might actually be more tricky to, if you have 50 patients going into a model, first of all, it's not enough data to train probably, but also you will quite easily be able to say, but this was this guy. So having new models, and there is something called federated learning, where it's basically everyone throws their data in a pool and then you get it out, but it's encoded in a way that no one can track their data back. And I think this would be, especially in the rare disease field, an amazing opportunity to share data among nonprofit organizations, but also among different players, biotech and pharma, who could make much better use of their data, have the AI interpret it, and then use the sparse data that they have to the best possible.
We've been talking about data protection in Europe, in Germany versus the US, for instance. And we also had guests that said naturally we're going to the US because there is more lax data protection. We have a different language of data protection leading to, for instance, worse understanding and fighting against rare diseases. Is that, at the end of the day, a problem that might pop up?
I'm not sure, I have to say. I think...
Or do you say that it's a blessing to have a stricter regulation at the end?
No, but I think there will be, within this field, because it's all on a quite personal level, there will be probably workarounds with consent that... can be.
And you were referring to the encrypted methods that are in place already that can, you know, sail around the regulatory framework. Yeah.
I think in this case, there will be probably workarounds, but I would probably not see that as the main issue, at least for the rare disease field. I think they're having, or for many of the diseases, having a treatment that makes your life better will probably beat this challenge. It will be more important.
So you referred to a total number that initially doesn't make rare diseases as an entirety rare at the end, because you mentioned the number of 350 million people on planet Earth. So it's a topic of high, high importance for the medical field. Where do we go with the help of AI? How quickly, how fast? One, worldwide, but then also in Europe, fighting those diseases. You mentioned both private companies and academic bodies that are doing research right now. But we mentioned many times in this podcast, from research to the street or to the clinic, it's quite a path, quite an achievement.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, when we were talking about the drug development, I think what I was getting at, I mean, we have this one side that's making it faster and cheaper, but we also have the other side and making it more successful and making it better. And I think there, given that many of these diseases have a genetic component, and a genetic component is something that you might tackle in a curative way, there is massive potential. And I think there, given that you have these use cases for AI, to also really link the genetic background to the symptomology and potentially also help in developing gene therapies or similar therapies. I think there is really a massive potential to find a treatment at all and have a treatment that actually really improves patients' lives, which I think, at least from the data that we discussed last year for Casgevy for sickle cell anemia, clearly seems to be the case. I mean, this will make people's lives a lot better. It's also very expensive. That said, maybe having this other function of AI, making things cheaper and faster, could work together to
make it more affordable.
Make it more affordable and overcome this challenge of having a drug that is so expensive that only selected parts of the world can actually take it. And I think this would be a great case for the rare disease community to have this opportunity of developing drugs that are not only better, but also more affordable. And I think their AI has the potential on so many levels to improve the process, to make things more streamlined, to make things faster, to really, cut out useless human labor in text reading, in document production, in note translating. None of that a human really needs to do. I think the AI can already do it. We'll talk about ChatGPT again next time, large language models. Mm-hmm. They can do pretty cool stuff nowadays.
There's a lot going on right now as we speak, as always, since we started the podcast and since the release of ChatGPT. So essentially you're saying the landscape when it comes to rare diseases will look different in 10 years to come.
Yes, I think so. But I think already, I mean, through these orphan instruments already, around 50% of new chemical entities, so new drugs that are based on small molecules, actually target orphan diseases. That means like half of the drugs are targeted towards rare diseases. The problem is there are so many of them that it's still only the tip of the iceberg. But the model is there. The companies are working on it. It's not that no one cares. It's really just that it needs to get easier. And there's initiatives like a Warp Speed initiative, for example, initiated by US regulators, but also many other European level and worldwide initiatives that really try to now move towards this space to tackle it. And I think it fits very well with many other developments because it fits well for the personalized medicine and it leaves the room for innovation. So I think it's actually really maybe not only transformative for a rare disease field, but it's just might be transformative for pharma.
And exactly this transformational question would be the last one from my side, which is, which one is the right place? Is this for the development, actually? Is this big pharma? Is this university? Or is it with the agile, innovative capacity, the startup that sits somewhere, maybe St. Louis or Berlin or Milano, you name it?
All of them.
All right. Okay.
Usually you have biotech driving innovation or also university maybe more for, or many academic researchers working towards better understanding the basics, using AI to help with it, having biotech driving innovation in drug development and also in AI, and having big pharma that is mostly the player who is able to bring drugs to market. And I think having all of them play together, but given that we're in the rare disease space, and I think this innovation that starts there could be leading into other fields of medicine and healthcare as well, being patient empowerment, because patients in the rare disease field are usually quite involved in their own, they want to understand the disease that they have, and they are often very involved in orchestrating treatment and care for themselves or for the people that they take care of, which makes a lot of sense. So for them, I think understanding the disease better, and again, they're having models such as large language models helping with diagnosing, you have much more informed patients suddenly that can not only help the doctor move in the right direction, but actually find the right doctor. Because, I mean, you have specialists, but you need to know if you have a diffuse set of symptoms, who is my specialist? I mean, who am I? Am I going to the heart doctor or to the lung doctor or to the kidney doctor? Or I don't know who could help me now. Some things are just super obvious, but many are not. This is one thing, but also in terms of understanding the landscape of clinical trials, because I think for many patients, given that there are so few patients, they would like to participate in a trial to test a new medicine that could help them, but maybe it's not so easy as non-expert finding those trials. And there are some AI tools at TrialGPT, for example, which again works based on the methodology of, I think, GPT-4 and helps people finding clinical trials for a certain set of symptoms and for certain patients. Super helpful and can be used by patients. So I think they are likely going to lead the way towards more innovation and maybe also dragging along sometimes their physicians and then interacting with the drug makers in order to get a better treatment and get better care.
Very, very, very different landscape from old school medicine and drug development that we're facing and that is happening right now. Izzy, we have one promise that you wanted to mention the Ozempic trailer.
Ozempic.
Oh, yeah.
I forgot how it continues.
Okay.
But
it doesn't matter anyway. Yeah. Nice melody.
Yeah. If you hear it once, it's always stuck in your head. And then you think, is Ozempic right for me? No, I'm kidding.
Okay.
I'm not.
You're not trying it. You're not getting it in Germany anyway. So
exactly.
If you're not diabetes.
Too bad. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're doomed, we're saved. Episode number 24, Rare Diseases. Thank you for listening. You find our podcast everywhere where good podcasts are at home. If you want to visit us, come to which place?
ScienceTales.com.
ScienceTales.com. And if you want us to tackle a problem or a biology revolution topic that we haven't mentioned before, please write us a little note and we'll take care of it, okay? Thank you.